Is deja vu more than just a quirk of the brain? Is there always a rational explanation for the paranormal? If I had the answers, I wouldn't have started this podcast or play crazy cool video games like Unknown 9 Awakening. Unknown 9 Awakening is the action-adventure video game at the heart of the Unknown 9 narrative universe. You play as Haruna, an audacious heroine with the ability to venture into the Fold, a mysterious dimension that overlaps our own. On her quest for powerful hidden knowledge, Haruna, who is portrayed by Anya Chalotra, will learn to master her unique connection to the Fold, which allows her to channel its powers into our world. But such power does not go unnoticed. Side note, the gameplay is beautiful. You can check the show notes for a link to see for yourself. But back to the story. Haruna quickly becomes a target of the Ascendants, a splinter faction of a secret society known as the Leap Year Society, who want to use the Fold to alter the course of human history. Would that really be so bad? Their confrontation will take them across the world, from the sands of Mauritania and perilous Indian jungles to the gothic landscapes of Portugal. Get ready to dive into a mysterious parallel dimension. Unknown 9 Awakening releases on October 18th, 2024 for PS4, PS5, Xbox One, Xbox Series X and S, and PC. Pre-order your copy today and learn more about the Unknown 9 universe at unknown9.com/hauntings. That's unknown9.com/hauntings. It is time to awaken.
Fall into big savings, all in the Kroger app. Get 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $4.99 each with your card and a digital coupon. Then buy one, get one free on our full line sale of tender Tyson chicken with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
October 18th, 1931 was an ordinary autumn night in Phoenix, Arizona. The thermometer had climbed to 89 degrees that afternoon, the beginning of the cool season in the desert community. The summer heat had been almost intolerable, and everyone looked forward to the milder days ahead. Most of the country would soon be fending off snow and freezing temperatures, but they didn't have that kind of winter here. That's why Phoenix had so many tourists in the wintertime. Although this winter, the tourists would be coming to town for more than just nice weather. The people attracted to Phoenix over the winter of 1931 and 32 would be among the morbid curious, and they'd be looking for a particular house. But I'm getting ahead of the story. October 18th was an ordinary evening for most people in Phoenix, but not for Winifred Ruth Judd, who most people called Ruthie. The 26-year-old daughter of a Methodist minister hadn't spent her day in church as she had on every Sunday of her life while growing up in Darlington, Indiana. In fact, her church attendance had been pretty lax since she'd left home 7 years earlier as the bride of a successful doctor who was 22 years older than she was. Her husband, Dr. William C. Judd, hadn't turned out to be as successful as his wife had expected. He found work as a doctor for American mining interests in Mexico, working for little money and whatever accommodations the company provided. He changed locations often and never held any post for long, and for good reason. Eventually, he had trouble getting any job at all because he was addicted to the narcotics he was prescribing to himself. To make matters worse for Ruthie, she'd followed her husband to Mexico only to contract tuberculosis. She left him in Mexico in 1930 and moved to Phoenix, where she hoped the dry air would offer her some relief from the disease. She soon found a six-day-a-week job at Phoenix's first private medical office, the Grunau Clinic. It paid $75 a month. Sunday was usually her only day off, but it was not unusual for her to spend part of the day working at home. She was a medical secretary responsible for typing up reports on exams for the doctors. With the rest of her day, she usually did laundry and cleaned her small apartment. On some Sundays, though, she had dinner with her two best friends, Annie LeRoy and Sammy Samuelson, who lived just a trolley ride away from her. They often pooled their money for something special. Fried chicken was a favorite, and Annie would cook. Then they'd turn up the radio and listen to their favorite shows. But Ruthie did none of those things on October 18th. On that day, she was busy packing. In fact, she'd been up all night packing, and now she needed help. She went to see her landlords, a kind couple who lived just across the alley from her apartment. Violet Grimm knew that something was wrong when Ruthie, her tenant, came to the door. She looked tired, and she seemed preoccupied and nervous. She was hoping that Violet's husband, Howard, could help her with some luggage. Howard was reading the newspaper when his wife told him that she'd volunteered him and their son for an errand. Ruthie was taking the night train to Los Angeles and needed some help loading her trunks. Well, he was happy to help. He didn't know Ruthie well, but she didn't throw loud parties, and she paid her rent on time. Besides that, she was a tiny thing, maybe 110 pounds and not even 5.5 feet tall. And she'd certainly need help moving anything that was very heavy. The train to Los Angeles was scheduled to leave at 8 p.m., so Howard and his son Kenneth came over early to help her. Ruthie was dressed in a plain brown suit when the men arrived. She pointed them toward the bedroom where they found two trunks, one large and one small. The big one was heavy. Ruthie said it had her husband's medical books in it, and he needed them for a new job. The trunk was so large they had to tie it on the running board of the car's passenger side. Kenneth managed a smaller trunk by himself, wedging it between the front and back seats. They dropped Ruthie off at the train station where she paid the baggage fees for her extra luggage. 3 hours later, they were loaded on the Golden State Limited when it pulled into the station, bound for Los Angeles. The baggage handler who loaded Ruthie's trunks on the train later said he thought he saw something leaking from the larger trunk, something he thought smelled like medicine, but he was in a hurry. Left the trunks in the baggage car and was on his way to his dinner break when the train pulled out of the depot. H.J. Mapps was the baggage man on the train that night, handling the duties between El Paso and Los Angeles. He'd been with the Southern Pacific Railroad for 23 years and had managed thousands of bags, so he knew right away that something was wrong with the large steamer trunk that had been loaded in Phoenix. He noticed a strange smell, and then when he looked closer, he was sure that it was leaking blood. As soon as he unloaded his car in Los Angeles at 7:45 a.m. the following morning, he notified District Baggage Agent Arthur V. Anderson they had a problem with the trunk. He assumed it was someone's hunting prize, badly packed, probably a deer. Anderson went out on the platform where the trunks had been loaded onto a flatbed truck. Even in the open air, he noticed a horrible odor. As he got closer, he saw blood running down the side of the trunk, and he thought Mapes was right. People were always trying to smuggle deer meat on the train to California. Health officials had demanded that the practice stop, so Anderson tagged both trunks with a pink hold slip, which meant the luggage couldn't be released without official approval. No one noticed the young woman in the brown suit who left the train that morning, except for a cleaning woman who worked in the depot. She only noticed her because she had two carry-on bags with her, one of which was a heavy suitcase the cleaning woman had moved out of the way in the restroom. The woman in the brown suit told her she didn't have enough money to check the bags while she went to her brother's home to get his car so that she could pick up her traveling trunks. Feeling sorry for her, the cleaning woman allowed her to leave the two bags with her. The woman promised she'd be back soon to get them, but by the time the cleaning woman's shift ended at 3 p.m., neither the woman in the brown suit nor her brother had come back to get them. George Brooker was the delivery clerk the next day at the station. He was filling out paperwork and noticed the pink-tagged trunks on the dock. When he walked over to write down their numbers, he noticed an awful smell. Something dark was leaking out of one of them. Around noon, a Ford Roadster pulled up to the loading dock. Brooker didn't recognize the man who got out of the car, but he recognized the young man who was with her. His name was Burton McKennell, and he was a college kid who had helped out at the station during the Christmas season. The young man handed Brooker two claim tickets, and he took them to the front office. Baggage agent Anderson came out personally to handle the situation with the pink tags. When he discovered the woman owned the bags, he asked her what was in them, but her reply was strange and evasive. She told him it was personal things and clothing. The woman acted as if nothing was wrong, saying she couldn't smell anything wrong with the trunk. Burton, though, looked horrified. He could see the stain on the concrete from the leaking fluid and noticed flies swarming around his sister's trunks. "Well, I can smell it," he blurted out. When Anderson ordered the woman to open the trunk, she became very nervous and told him she didn't have the keys. Her husband had them, she said. She explained she'd have to telephone her husband to bring the keys to the station. Anderson offered the use of his office phone, and she made a show of thumbing through the phone book, claiming she didn't remember her husband's number and then said she couldn't find it listed. Finally, she assured Anderson that she would go and get her husband and they'd return to the station. The man with her, her brother Burton, looked as though he had no idea what was going on. Anderson watched as the two of them calmly walked to the car and drove away. And they never came back. Anderson waited until 4:30 that afternoon, and then he called the police and reported two suspicious trunks. Detective Frank Ryan's shift was almost over when the call came in. He hoped to go straight home after a quick stop at the train station, but the 10-year veteran detective was going to be in for a long night. When Ryan joined Anderson on the loading dock, he took one look at the large trunk and knew he was looking at blood. He'd seen way too much of it over his last decade with the LAPD. The detective picked open the lock on the larger trunk. When he lifted the lid, he saw a piece of rug on top. He moved it aside and found some books and papers. And beneath that layer were fragments of women's clothing, some of it smeared with blood. The clothing was piled on top of an old quilt. Ryan lifted the corner of the quilt and instinctively jerked his hand away. He was looking at a woman's face. As he pulled his hand back, the quilt was gripped tightly in his fist. He pulled it aside to reveal the body of a woman who was crammed into the trunk. She had dark hair and was wearing pink pajamas. She was on her side, her head in one corner and her knees drawn up to her chest. Detective Ryan let the lid of the trunk slam shut with a thud, rushed into the depot office, and called precinct headquarters for fingerprint man and for the morgue. As he waited for them to arrive, he opened the smaller trunk. Several sheets of paper lay on top, some spattered with blood. A thin cotton blanket was stuffed around the contents. Under it were two bundles wrapped in women's clothing. He unwrapped them to find a human foot, a leg from the knee down, and a woman's torso from the head to the navel. Frank Ryan had seen enough. He'd wait for the boys from the lab and wouldn't touch anything else, but he already knew something that made him feel sick. The pieces in this trunk didn't add up to a whole body. Well, he didn't know it yet, but there were two other bags waiting for him in the station. And when he did find out, he was able to piece together the bodies of two women and begin one of the strangest investigations of his career. Welcome to American Hauntings, the podcast dedicated to the history, hauntings, legends, lore, and the dark side of American history. And welcome to Season 8, Home, which is written and performed by Troy Taylor, that's me, and produced and co-hosted by Cody Beck. This season, we're on a cross-country trip in search of America's murder houses, relics of time and crime gone by. We're going behind the locked doors of both famous and little-known places where murder and violence have left lingering ghosts behind. In this episode, we'll be going backwards from the gruesome discovery made in the LA train station to a bungalow in Phoenix, Arizona, where our bizarre and bloody story began. It would turn into one of the strangest crimes that both cities had ever seen. And the whole thing has an ending that you won't see coming. To explain how two trunks and a couple of smaller suitcases ended up containing the bodies of two dead women, we have to turn back the clock a bit to Christmas of 1930, not long after Ruthie had arrived in Phoenix. She didn't have her job at the medical clinic yet, that would come later. Instead, she went to work for a wealthy family named Ford, caring for an invalid wife and watching the children. It was room and board and $80 a week. Ruthie was just the kind, caring, church-going, no-troubled young woman the family wanted. While living with them, she met their friends and neighbors, including Jack Halloran, who lived next door. And that's where the trouble began. Jack was 44 years old and was a local success story. He was one of the most prominent men in town, and he and his wife and three children lived in the nicest neighborhood in Phoenix. He was well-liked, admired, and politically connected. You couldn't find anyone in the city who'd say a bad word about him. But unknown to most people in town, Jack was a playboy who never let his wife get in the way of a good time. He and Ruthie started seeing each other whenever Jack's wife was busy or out of town, which seemed to be most of the time. Eventually, Ruthie was lured away from the Ford family for a political job that paid $125 a week. Ruthie left the family, only to get fired after her new boss lost the election. Luckily, she was soon hired on at the Grunau Clinic, where she was able to meet one of her soon-to-be best friends who got a job there as an X-ray technician. Her friend was Agnes Annie Leroy, and she had been living next door to Ruthie when she first moved to town with their friend and roommate, Hedvig Sammy Samuelson. The two young women were an outgoing pair that everyone just called the girls, which they didn't mind, even though Annie was 32 and Sammy was 24. Well, it seemed natural the three women became friends. All were newcomers to Phoenix and far from their hometowns. The friendship between Annie and Sammy was already strong by the time they arrived in town together in 1931. They'd met in Alaska, where Annie had worked as a nurse and Sammy was a teacher. While living there, Sammy contracted tuberculosis, and the pair moved to Phoenix for the same reason Ruthie had, hoping the dry climate would ease Sammy's condition. When the girls arrived in town, Ruthie was already working as a medical secretary at the Grunau Clinic. Annie was hired on as a X-ray technician, and she and Ruthie became friends. They started visiting during coffee breaks, going to lunch together, and spending time in the evenings. Ruthie invited Annie and Sammy to her apartment for dinner, and they asked her back. Soon, they even became neighbors. Annie and Sammy lived in a bungalow duplex on the edge of town, just a few blocks off the trolley line. Ruthie moved in to the other half of the house when it became available in May 1931, and the three women became inseparable. Over the next few months, Sammy was in and out of hospitals. The dry air didn't seem to help her condition. Then Annie found out that she also had tuberculosis. And by June, she was too sick to work and wanted to go home to her family and rest for a few weeks. But she feared losing her job and didn't have enough money to make the trip. Ruthie pleaded with the doctors to hold Annie's job for her and even to give her some traveling money. And one of the doctors was so moved, he wrote Annie a check for $100. With Annie gone, Sammy moved into a sanatorium so she could get daily care when she needed it, and Ruthie moved into the girls' half of the duplex. By July, things were looking up. Annie's health had improved enough to return to Phoenix and go back to work, so Ruthie moved Sammy back into the bungalow, caring for her friend until the three women were reunited in August. After Annie returned, she almost lost her job again. One doctor at the clinic wasn't fond of Annie and had trained a young nurse to run the X-ray machine in her absence. He didn't feel Annie's specialized skills were needed anymore. But Ruthie pleaded on her friend's behalf again, and soon Annie was back to work. The three women remained living together for only 2 months. In early October, Ruthie found her one-bedroom apartment across town. It was only a couple of blocks from the clinic, and it allowed her to walk to work each day instead of paying the daily fare for the trolley ride from the house. But Ruthie would soon come to regret her decision to move. While living in the bungalow, Ruthie had become caught up in the party lifestyle of her friends. The place was often the scene of wild gatherings for mostly married men and their out-of-town friends. If a local guy needed to show a good time to a visiting businessman he was trying to sell something to, he could always bring him to Annie and Sammy's house, where there was music, pretty girls, and bootleg liquor. Often the local men brought gifts for the girls, like their new Philco radio, or left cash behind on the table. And who was the local guy that visited most often? Tall, handsome, broad-shouldered Jack Halloran, Ruthie's boyfriend, who she'd introduced to Sammy and Annie. And that was another thing she'd started to regret. And that's how life in Phoenix went for the three women until the night of October 16th, 1931, a day and a half before Ruthie Judd took those two steamer trunks and those two suitcases to Los Angeles. A lot of what happened on that night remains mysterious, which is mostly due to Ruthie's often changing stories and the baffling details she offered about the murders. What we do know is that Ruthie started that Friday evening at home, still fuming over Jack's failure to show up on time for their date the night before. And when he did show up, instead of spending the night with the two of them together, they ended up at Sammy and Annie's bungalow. Ruthie knew that Jack and his friends spent a lot of time at the bungalow, but he told her that Ruthie was the one he wanted, regardless of his other flirtations. But that didn't do much to stop her jealousy. She'd found out that Jack was responsible for more than bringing bootleg liquor to their parties and handing out the occasional gift. He also frequently slipped them considerable sums of money. She'd also seen him flirt shamelessly with both Annie and Sammy. She was jealous of them and knew they were jealous of her in return, or so she believed. The more Ruthie stewed about her friends flirting with Jack, the angrier she got, and she eventually decided to take the streetcar to the bungalow. Another friend, Evelyn Ney, said also stopped by that night, and after dinner, they played bridge, talked, and laughed until the party finally broke up around 9:30. Annie and Sammy walked Evelyn to the door and said goodbye. Ruthie decided to spend the night on the pull-out couch in the living room. Annie loaned her a pair of pink polka dot pajamas, and they chatted for a couple of hours before the lights were turned out. It seemed to be an unremarkable Friday night for the three women. They'd been together like this dozens of times. There was nothing to suggest that this night would be any different. But by the time this night was over, Annie and Sammy would be dead, each with a bullet in their head. Annie's body would be stuffed into the bottom of a steamer trunk, and Sammy's body would be cut into four pieces. And Ruthie would be a killer. After the trunks were opened at LA's Union Station, the police traced the license number on the car to Burton. He already knew what was in the trunks. His sister had told him as they were driving away from the station. He was in shock, but Ruthie told him the less he knew, the better off he was. When he stopped at a light, she asked for a few dollars, then jumped out of the car and vanished into the crowd. The police started a search, one that newspapers would call the largest manhunt in the history of the West. But keep in mind, they said that about pretty much every manhunt. But even so, hundreds of officers in California and Arizona were looking for her. Nine women who matched her description were detained and questioned. They grilled her husband, who was now in L.A., and her brother for hours. They interviewed her landlords and neighbors back in Phoenix, everyone she worked with, and anyone even remotely connected to the three women. They looked into her personal life and the lives of the victims. And they fed it all to eager reporters who passed the story on to the public, who quickly became obsessed. Few crimes had seen the kind of coverage given to Winnie Ruth Judd, and few killers had instantly become a household name across the country. The public's fascination was a morbid mix of disgust and glee. The tabloids had a field day. Two-inch headlines screamed about the Velvet Tigress, the Blonde Butcher, the Wolf Woman, and of course, the Trunk Murderess, which was the one that really stuck. Phoenix papers were obviously obsessed with the stunning hometown crime, and entire news staffs were assigned to cover the story. But the fascination of Los Angeles papers rivaled even those in Phoenix. They could claim it was a hometown crime since the bodies were discovered there. And the newspapers offered huge rewards for stories and information. Everyone was searching for Ruthie. But she disappeared. On Monday night, October 19th, it was announced that the police had finally found the missing parts of Sammy's body. Someone had noticed the two suitcases, and after the excitement over the bloody trunks, station officials called the police. Inside, they found Sammy's torso from her waist to her knees, wrapped in pajamas and a blanket. In the other one, they found an empty black surgeon's bag, surgical dressings, women's undergarments, makeup, a .25 caliber Colt automatic pistol, and a box of cartridges. The discovery sparked another round of extra editions of the city's newspapers. But Ruthie was still missing. Meanwhile, the investigation continued. A delivery driver was found who'd moved the trunks and suitcases from the bungalow to Ruthie's apartment. The police found a satchel of surgical instruments in her apartment, leading them to believe that the women had been dismembered there. The police were convinced Annie and Sammy had been murdered in the bedroom of the bungalow. Both mattresses were missing from the beds. There were blood spatters under one bed covering the floor and splashing up as high as the baseboard, but no blood on the walls. The police later found one mattress with no bloodstains on it in a vacant lot miles away from the bungalow. The other mattress was never found. Well, the public demanded to know Ruthie's motives. The three women didn't seem to have argued. Only Ruthie's recent move to her own apartment seemed to show any kind of friction between them. So there had to be more. Was Ruthie insane, or was she a killer who carefully premeditated and orchestrated the death of her best friends, as the prosecution in her case would tell the jury? Or more intriguing was the theory suggested by a few detectives and reporters that Ruthie hadn't committed the murders at all. She just badly tried to cover them up. They believed she'd had an accomplice. As the manhunt continued, the Phoenix papers reported the latest bits of news about the accomplice theory. It was reported that the police found, quote, startling evidence at the bungalow that proved there was an accomplice, but they never spelled out what that evidence was. Either the police never told reporters what they'd found, or the newsmen decided to keep it a secret, which seems really unlikely to me. Detectives were quoted about making progress in the case and were confident they would soon identify the accomplice. But then, suddenly, officials changed their minds. The police and the county attorney backtracked, telling the media that regardless of their earlier theories, it was clear that Ruthie Judd had acted alone. There was no explanation in the newspapers for this change of mind. No one even tried to explain the evidence that detectives supposedly had. The police simply said they were wrong. It was Ruthie acting by herself the whole time. She killed Annie and Sammy and then tried to ship their bodies to Los Angeles. But was this the truth? Or was the theory discarded when it began pointing toward the person who was the most obvious choice of suspects for an accomplice? Jack Halloran, Ruthie's secret boyfriend and one of the most prominent men in Phoenix. Jack was way too well connected to city officials and politicians and the wealthiest men in the city to be dragged into a seedy murder case like this one. He was a successful businessman, community leader, family man, on the board of the Chamber of Commerce, member of the Knights of Columbus, president of the Southwest Golf Association, and an Elks Club member. He wasn't a killer, even if he was a serial womanizer. Well, naturally, he denied having anything to do with the murder. His only sin had been in associating with the girls. LA newspapers raked him over the coals, but the papers in Phoenix were, of course, much kinder. Most of the information the police learned about him was never revealed, and it was made clear by editors they didn't want anything negative reported about Jack Halloran. Even the county attorney, Lloyd Andrews, balked when asked by a LA reporter for a comment about Jack's involvement in the murders. "That's nonsense," he said. Jack Halloran is a friend of mine. He's a fine fellow. Everyone liked Jack. He was an esteemed member of the community. He wasn't a single woman, living on her own, barely making enough money to make ends meet, whose best friends were a couple of party girls known for entertaining a variety of men. Not Jack. Jack was a great guy, just ask anyone. Winnie Ruth Judd, though, on the other hand, was a killer. Jack Halloran was never officially named as a suspected accomplice of Ruthie Judd, and he would never be arrested or even seriously questioned. But the same wouldn't be said for Ruthie. Ruthie finally gave herself up on October 23, 1931. When she'd left her brother on that day she arrived in Los Angeles, she vanished by walking 20 miles to an abandoned building on the grounds of the Lavina Sanatorium in the hills above Altadena. She'd once been a patient at the hospital in hopes of treating her tuberculosis. She hid in the building for 3 days, sneaking into the kitchen at night for food. But then Ruthie saw an ad in the newspaper, paid for by her husband, begging her to give herself up. She called Dr. Judd in his attorney's office, and he pleaded with her and finally convinced Ruthie to give herself up. When Ruthie was taken into custody, she sobbed, "I had to shoot her! I had to shoot her!" Well, this didn't make sense to the police and reporters at the time, but soon it would. Ruthie was extradited to Arizona, where she would be tried for murder. As a defense, she said that she had argued with the girls and that Sammy got hold of a gun, and they struggled, and the weapon fell. Annie grabbed an ironing board and tried to hit Ruthie over the head with it, but Ruthie got to the gun, shot Sammy, and then turned the gun on Annie, who was still coming at her with the ironing board. So Ruthie had to shoot her. She hadn't wanted to do it. It was self-defense. Ruthie admitted to being a killer, but not a murderer. It was no crime to kill someone in self-defense, but what about the rest of it? People who kill in self-defense don't usually cut up their victims and hide them in trunks. They don't travel hundreds of miles to dispose of the bodies. No, they call the police. So Ruthie was either lying or, as one detective put it, she was nuts. Ruthie Judd's trial began on January 19th, 1932. Ruthie's version of events to the cops was that the murders occurred in self-defense. Her lawyers, meanwhile, claimed she was obviously insane. The prosecution maintained it had all been premeditated, the work of a jealous woman. What Ruthie was thinking during the trial remains unknown. She never took the stand, so we'll never know what she would have actually said in her own defense. But on February 8, 1932, she was found guilty of murder and sentenced to death by hanging the following year. By the time her execution date got closer, Ruthie had managed to drum up a lot of sympathy and a lot of support. There were accusations of shoddy police work, suspicions about an accomplice, a belief that she really had been defending herself, and of course, her lawyers continued assertions that she was mentally ill. Public opinion across the country was on her side. Thousands of people, including First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt, petitioned the state of Arizona to reconsider the death penalty in her case. Many complained that if there had been an accomplice, Ruthie's testimony might be needed later. Some maintained it was inconceivable to execute a woman, and some begged that she be spared for the sake of her elderly parents. Well, it was painfully clear to Arizona business leaders, politicians, and residents that the negative publicity from the case was the last thing the state needed. Arizona's booster campaigns declared it a place where good people raised healthy families in a warm climate. How could they explain executing a woman with so much public support? There was only one option available. Arizona law at the time allowed the state prison warden, appointed by the governor, to call for a sanity hearing for death row inmates. So just days before her execution, a panel was formed for the hearing, which, after an examination, spared Ruthie the noose, but she was ordered to spend the rest of her life at the Arizona State Mental Hospital. But with a story this bizarre, that's not the end. Not long after Ruthie arrived at the asylum, she escaped. And then she escaped again. And again. for a total of 7 times. Her last escape was in 1962, and she stayed on the loose for the next 7 years, living in Northern California under an assumed name, Marion Ruth Lane. She quietly worked as a live-in housekeeper for Mrs. Ethel Nichols. Gone was the blonde beauty who loved to drink and dance and murdered her best friends. A kind, matronly woman took her place and became beloved by the Nichols family. She lived in a lovely apartment behind the Nichols home on a street of opulent houses. She was paid $400 a month plus room and board and Ruthie's Social Security. Mrs. Nichols bought all of Ruthie's clothes for her, her uniforms, and her aprons. The Nichols loved to entertain, and Ruthie became the favorite cook in the neighborhood. At the age of 60, Ruthie even went back to school in her spare time. She enrolled in night school at the Oakland College of Assistants. She was offered a job in a doctor's office, but decided to stay with the Nichols family. When Mrs. Nichols passed away, her daughter, also named Ethel, and her husband, John Blemmer, invited her to live on their farm north of San Francisco. There was a small guest house on the property, and Ethel suggested it would be the perfect place for Ruthie to live out her retirement. The family adored her and wanted to keep her around. She was still unpacking and settling into the house where she planned to live the rest of her life when everything unraveled. The police finally caught up with her in 1969. But the Blemmers hired famed attorney Melvin Belli to represent Ruthie. He stated it was outrageous for anyone to punish this woman further. He unsuccessfully fought her extradition back to Arizona and then attacked the length of time she'd already served for her crime, praised her rehabilitation, and did everything he could to paint her in a good light after all the years that had passed. And finally, in 1971, Arizona Governor Jack Williams granted her a pardon. The Blemmers welcomed her home with open arms, and Ruthie returned to her quiet life as Marion Lane. She passed away in her sleep in 1998 at the age of 93. Well, in the end, we're left with a mystery. We'll never know for sure what happened on that night in Phoenix when Ruthie's two best friends ended up dead. Ruthie always admitted she killed them, but whether it was self-defense or not remains a mystery. Did she have an accomplice who helped her try to get rid of the bodies? Maybe, or even probably. It seems difficult to believe she would murder her two friends and then cut one up into pieces so she could more easily fit her in some luggage by herself. But the murders did happen, and so did the dismemberment. Ruthie may not have acted alone, but she was there. Why did she haul the bodies to Los Angeles to get rid of them when she lived in a town surrounded by hundreds of miles of open desert, canyons, mountains, and wild spots where they would have never been found? Why did she take them as luggage on a train? And what did she plan to do with the bodies when she got to LA? Honestly, we'll never know. There will always be questions about the story of Winnie Ruth Judd that no amount of searching will ever answer. But the story isn't over quite yet. In the aftermath of the murders, the Phoenix bungalow became a macabre tourist attraction as Ruthie's case became a media sensation. Local residents hurried to the site, and some curiosity seekers even traveled from distant cities to get a look at the bungalow, hoping to peer into the windows of the place where Ruthie had committed murder, cut up her friends, and maybe even stuff them into a suitcase. The duplex bungalow had begun its life in the 1920s as a rental house, and it remained a residence for nearly a century after that, going through a long succession of owners. In 2016, there were rumors it would be demolished, and it was surrounded by chain-link fencing, but the property was soon purchased by a local attorney who turned it into his law offices, and perhaps that's for the best, because its time as a family home was never a happy one. Memories of the past are never really far away inside that bungalow. There are original fixtures from the 1930s that survive. Among them are the bathtub where Ruthie may have dismembered one of her victims before packing her into a suitcase. The original oak floors are still in place, so are the fireplace mantles and light fixtures that were there when Annie and Sammy lived, loved, laughed, and died in the house. And those items, as well as the house itself, may hold some of the residue from those days gone by. The house is not considered to be haunted, not in the traditional sense, but there is something that has lingered here, making its presence known for decades. You see, locally, the bungalow gained a reputation as, quote, the house where love dies. Couples often bought it together as their dream house, and then things turned sour, ending in arguments, bickering, and finally, divorce. Coincidence or just simply a high divorce rate in Phoenix? I don't know. Maybe that's all it is. But this house seems to have a worse track record than others in the neighborhood. There is something rumored to just be bad about the place. And no amount of distance between the murders that happened there and the present day seems able to make that reputation go away. Stay with us for the rest of the show and find out how you can win free stuff after these important messages from our sponsors.
Fall into big savings, all in the Kroger app. Get 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $4.99 each with your card and a digital coupon. Then buy one, get one free on our full line sale of tender Tyson chicken with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Forgot my iPad, so I'm using my phone again. So if I'm squinting, you'll know why. So
all good.
Anyway, all right. Well, welcome back to American Haunties, and thanks to all who've joined us for episode number 17 of our latest season. My name is Troy Taylor. I'm the creator of American Hauntings, and I wrote and narrated this episode while sipping a gin Ricky and listening to some jazz music on the record player with a couple of friends of mine. And sitting over on the couch with Annie is my editor, producer, co-host, and the guy who mixed my cocktail, Cody Back.
Yeah, I'm going to take my feet off this trunk right now. And
But somebody might need it later. Exactly. Yes.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I mean, talk about, you know, hell hath no fury and stuff. And that's, this is an interesting one. We'll dive into it, but damn.
Sure.
I don't want a trunk to be my casket, you know?
No, I wouldn't think so either.
Yeah.
So,
I want to be able to, I want to end up in some place that I can fit 100% good to go, stretched out, laid out.
Yeah. Yeah. Instead of just curled up and then, you know, maybe need a couple of suitcases for the other guy. So, you know,
yes.
No, thanks.
Gosh.
So.
Yeah. We'll dive into that. But dude, what's been going on? How are things? What do you got
busy,
coming up? What
else? Busy, busy, you know, just a lot of stuff going on. I mean, it is that time of year. And somehow I managed to make my September just as busy as my October.
Yeah. You talked about that.
I don't know how that happened. I'm positive now thinking about it. I must've said, oh gosh, I'm too busy in October. What about September? And then there it went, but it's okay. We've got stuff because I'm already planning ahead because, you know, before we know it, October will be over too. And then, you know, we'll be thinking, well, now what? So, well, we've got our Dead of Winter event up and running. So we've got speakers, a good list of speakers. If you check us out on AmericanHauntings.net, you'll see the link for Dead of Winter for this year, or well, next year, technically. Mm-hmm. And you'll see, you know, we've got Brandon Schexnader from Southern Gothic. We've got a bunch of people coming for that one. It's going to be a good year. And, you know, we always enjoy the Dead of Winter event. We get to do a live show, which is okay. Well, we don't enjoy that.
We enjoy the rest of it.
Yeah. But we'll have the VIP packages again. We'll be having it at the Best Western premiere this year. So it will have a little more room to move around. We won't be so cold, which will be nice. And we'll have a couple of, we got a ghost hunt. We got a couple of different things, dinner and some other stuff going on that weekend too. So people can check all that out. Like I said, the website's AmericanHauntings.net. So yeah, come see us. Bring your canned food and, you know, all that stuff. And I'm sure we'll talk more about that later, but it seems early, but It's not, because it's February 1st this year. Wow. That was the way that it worked out. We couldn't do it a little later in the month because of other things that were already booked at the hotel. So we moved it up a little earlier. So anyway, but speaking of Halloween, on Halloween night, we're bringing back the old Houdini seance that we used to do for years and years. We did that thing for so long. It was a lot. It's always been fun. So I thought we'd bring it back this year. And we're holding it at the American Oddities Museum because we have some Houdini stuff right there in the case. So we thought, hey, if it's ever going to happen, and it probably won't, but you never know.
Never know.
It's going to be it might be there. So we'll see. So if you get a chance, check it out. It's at dinnerandspirits.com. You can get signed up. We're a little over half full right now, so we will not have a lot of space left for this thing here pretty quick once we get into the Halloween season. So, but you get a chance, come by the museum at any point. We're open every weekend, every Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, 12 to 5. We got a couple of dates in October when we're going to have special pop-up shows. River City Oddities will be there one weekend. Oren, my son, will be there with his art. His wife will be there with her pottery one weekend. So we've got special things going on. We've got a big event coming at the end of November where we'll be not only expanding the museum, but doing something pretty special. But I'm going to talk about that a little bit later. So
awesome.
I'm saving that one for now. But anyway, get a chance to come by the museum sometime and stop in and see us. We've had a lot of really great people who've come to like recent events and shows and things that have been podcast listeners. So, you know, people are always like, I hear your voice all the time.
I know.
So yeah, we've had some really great people who've been in, and a lot of them traveled quite a ways to get there. And Trey was telling me that my buddy who manages the museum for me was telling me he gets people come in for 3 or 4 hours away, you know, just because they listen to the podcast and wanted to see the museum. So we've added a lot of stuff, and it has been really fun doing it. And looking forward to continuing to do it. So stop in and visit us sometime if you're in town.
That's awesome. And I have some artwork from Oren too, right next to my bedroom door. And it's this piece of art. It says, check under the bed. And people are like, what is that? And I'm like, that's a reason for you to stay out of out of my room.
That's what that means.
So. He has some cool stuff. And then is the Houdini one, is that when you're doing the Estes method stuff, or is that a
different one? No, that's actually later. November 22nd, we're doing a special event at the museum. An Estes method experiment. Just limited number of people can attend. Mm-hmm. And we're going to be, we'll be getting out some of the items. We've done this before. We did this at the conference a few years ago, using, you know, haunted and alleged haunted items. But we're going to be getting out some items and letting people use them for experiments with the Estes method. And if you're familiar with it, you know that it's one of the more, I think, compelling methods of investigation these days. If you haven't checked it out, there's an explanation about it on the website. If you go to dinnerandspirits.com, you'll find it listed for November 22nd.
It's more scientific.
It's pretty cool. And so we're going to be doing that at the museum with some of the objects in the museum, plus the museum itself, which is, you know, filled with all kinds of things that we brought in, and we've had a lot of activity there since we opened. And it's, you know, a chance to experience something cool. So yeah, we encourage people to check that out, because I think that a lot of people know, if you listen to the podcast, you know that there will be no more ghost hunts at the Mineral Springs in the future. The new owners of the building have decided that there won't be any more ghost hunts hosted there. I mean, the museum's not going anywhere. The Mineral Springs isn't closing. Our tours are still going to just start from there as they've done for the last several years, but there won't be any more ghost hunts. They don't want to have them in the building anymore. They've got a variety of reasons, none of which I think are valid, but that's the way it goes. I don't own the building. So I just have to say we won't be having any more. And the ones that we do have left, they've sold out in about a day and a half after we announced that news. So anyway, that's the way it goes. But come by. You can still take part in something at the Mineral Springs, because that's where the museum is. But, you know, technically, that's not part of the rest of the building. So it's a, I know we're it's a fine, it's a gray area, but so what? Anyway, check it out. I think you will enjoy it if you want to give it a try. We'll have equipment on hand, so you don't even have to have spirit boxes and headphones and all that stuff. You're welcome to bring yours if you want, but you don't have to have them. So right. Anyway, there you go.
Awesome. Well, I want to give a shout out to our new subscribers on Patreon. So thank you very much for supporting the show to Vale, Josh, Drew, Laura, and Elizabeth. Thank you very much for supporting the show. You know, we couldn't and wouldn't do this.
That's
sort of
right.
Stuff
that's here. Right. And if you're not familiar with Patreon, you can check it out. We have a there's a website for it, patreon.com/AmericanHauntings. We do an alternate podcast that is that's separate from this one. And we've got three seasons on there already that you can binge. And in fact, you can binge most of it, season four, because it's almost over. But we post those shows every other week, so you can go every single week and get a show from us. So check it out if you get a chance. I mean, there's other things too, discounts and all kinds of stuff. But the podcast, I think, is the big draw.
That's the big
that's
one.
The reason that I sign up with other podcasts. You know, I've got other shows that I am a supporter of through Patreon. And that's why I do it, because I get ad free or at least alternate shows and
same here.
Things like that. Yeah, it's great. So
absolutely. Yeah. Well, I want to dive in to a listener review before we jump into the story. This one is from the 208, and it's titled Daily Passengers. And it goes, I stumbled onto this podcast a couple weeks ago and was instantly hooked. I'm a history nerd and love learning things on all these places. I really love the St. Louis season, specifically the episodes on the Limps and the Exorcism. Season 3 is really good, as well as really piques my criminal justice background. Troy and Cody have become my daily passengers as I drive around making my deliveries. The banter with the outro is hilarious, but I definitely like the shorter one for the current season. I understand.
Yeah, we do too.
Yeah, keep up the great work, and I'm looking forward to getting Troy's books on the St. Louis Exorcism as well as the Axe Murders. So thank you very much for writing in, and yeah, I agree with almost everything you said. I don't know, as far as us being your pat, like
yeah,
spending the whole day with us,
yeah,
man, that seems
it seems rough to me, but yeah, what do I know?
Whatever works for you. Okay, Troy, I would have titled this episode Encyclopedia Brown and the Case of the Leaky Luggage, I guess.
Yeah, yeah, like that, you know? That's a pretty good one. Yeah, that'd be right? A good title. So
yeah, yeah, so this is one of the ones where I know you do as much work as you can and figure out as much information as you can. So, but it's one where we don't have a ton of growing up background info.
No, I really had to cut this story down. It's complicated. It's even more complicated than it is.
Right.
And I could have really filled in a lot of background on everyone involved, but it would have been like a, you know, 3-hour podcast
or
something. So I had to kind of cut it down to the meat and potatoes, if you know, don't mind me using cut down and meat as a description. But yeah, it's an interesting story, and it's definitely complex. I mean, yeah. and does, as I mentioned at the end, kind of leave a gap as to far as why in the world she did it. You know, because this seems extreme to me. You know, I mean, I could see shooting. Well, the self-defense, you know, murder thing, I at least you could understand, you know. Sure, I can understand a lot of people wouldn't want to call the police, you know, but on the other hand, why go to all this when, as I mentioned, she could have just threw the bodies in the back of the car and drove out into the desert, man. You
right.
Live in Phoenix here. I mean, there are thousands of square miles out there of, you know, empty desert, and where you could dump these bodies where they'd never be found. And instead, she goes to all the trouble to put them in luggage and moves them from, you know, gets a mover to take them from the bungalow to her apartment, and then talks her, you know, her landlord's husband and his son into taking them to the train station for her. And then she moves them to LA for no reason.
I mean, her
brother's there. Her husband is now there, which she, you know, hadn't had a lot to do with anyway. But now, you know, she's got this leaking trunk,
yeah,
you know, and it's pretty awful.
It is. I think this might be one of the ones where we're trying to put ourselves in the mind of somebody that's
impossible. Yeah.
But yeah, you're totally right. There are much easier ways to go about this. And just the fact that like there are some like books and papers and things and blankets and like stuff to kind of sort of help, but not really.
Yeah,
like
it's not really
a shoddy job. Like all
yeah. Around. I mean the point like throwing a blanket on top of a body and it's like. But it's leaking. So, yeah, I mean, if you open the trunk, you're going to try to find out what's leaking and you're going to find a dead body.
Right.
A blanket is not going to hide that, you know?
I would just imagine, I mean, Ruthie, what I would imagine is that, you know, you talk about Annie and Sammy and having, you know, paying attention to Jack and all that sort of stuff. There must have been some more intense love triangle, something jealousy going on.
I don't know if there is. There's no record of it.
Right.
I mean, there certainly could have been because, I mean, Jack chased anything in his skirt.
Yeah, of course. One of those.
This was a guy who really just thought he was untouchable. And I, you know, when they used to come over and hang out at the bungalow and have big parties there and he'd bring his pals around and stuff. And then, you know, Ruthie finds out that he's slipping him cash and he's bought him a new radio, which, you know, was not a minor expense at the time. It would be like probably the equivalent of, you know, you buying your girlfriend a big screen TV or something, you know. And so that seems sketchy to Ruthie, who's obviously unbalanced anyway.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe the cash and maybe she just assumed that there was more going on than that. Honestly, in truth, there's a lot of speculation that the girls were actually in love with each other. But that's not something that people talked about at the time.
I was already
That has come up and I didn't get into it in depth because, well, it was already a long episode. And so, you know, there was no proof of that any more than there was proof that, you know, Jack was involved with either one of them. And so there may be more motivations to this than, you know, what we've seen. I'm hoping this is on my list of books to write at some point. So I'm hoping that at some point I'll be able to dive into this a little deeper and present a lot more of the story than I can with just an episode of the podcast.
But of course. And you mentioned 2-inch headlines screamed about the Velvet Tigress, the Blonde Butcher, Wolf Woman, and of course, Trunk Murderess, which is the one that really struck.
Yeah, the trunk murder thing and the trunk murderess, that's the one that really stuck.
Yeah.
You know, the other ones are, you know, They tried. You know,
well, you got to shop.
We find that a lot. We've talked about that a lot in other episodes.
Screen door murder.
And then, they really tend to do it most with women because they loved back then to give women these names. You know, there's a great story. And I think we might have talked about the woman who murdered her husband's mistress in the car with the hammer. Did we talk about that? I don't remember if that was in our California. I think it was in our murder
Hollywood or something.
Yeah, Hollywood thing. And I think maybe it was in our murder episode, but I don't remember because I know I've talked about it
too many
different times over the years. They called her the Tiger Woman because it looked like the victim had been mauled. So they're always looking for some kind of name for women, you know. And so Trunk Murderess is the one that really seemed to stick for whatever reason. So.
And did I miss this? I know we talked about accomplices and things like that and the police like saying, no, we're wrong and all that.
Yeah.
But something I am curious about. We didn't seem to find enough blood anywhere on a mattress.
Yeah. Right? Well, and that's why there were competing theories as to whether or not she had dismembered the girls at the bungalow, which makes more sense to me. I don't know how she couldn't have done it there, even though the police said they thought she did it at her apartment, which makes no sense because
you gotta move.
How did she get her there? Because there wasn't a big enough, there was only one trunk, you know, so we had one trunk and then these smaller cases that she used and cut up Sammy. So it's a really good chance, I'd say, that the blood was, well, that the dismemberment was done in the bathroom at the bungalow, probably over the tub, and that the blood was just drained down the tub.
Right.
But since she didn't, and then those didn't leak, you know, those cases didn't leak. It was the trunk that had a whole body in it. You know, Annie's entire body was in that trunk, and it's the one that leaked everywhere.
Right.
So I'm thinking that that's probably why, and that the dismemberment was done at the bungalow.
I gotcha.
You know, so, I mean, that's probably where the murder took place. But even so, it does seem like, you know, there was a suggestion at the time that there was an accomplice, that mm-hmm. maybe somebody helped her. But I don't think that's probably the case. If she could get that, well, she didn't have to, because she had a delivery guy come and pick up the trunk and take it to her apartment. So I don't think she had to have had help, except from people who didn't know any better. Mm-hmm. You know, the delivery guy and the landlord's husband and then his son. I don't think she needed any help. But that was something that first the police were stuck on, and then I think that probably someone in the DA's office went, you got to stop talking about this. We're never going to be able to prosecute yeah. this woman.
Yeah.
And then they completely changed their mind and said, oh, wait, no, she did it all on her own, which I think she probably did. It would have been tough to get someone to not talk under those circumstances. And who would it have been anyway? Because Annie and Sammy were her best friends. You know, Jack was this boyfriend. He certainly wasn't going to help her. And, you know, he was in enough hot water when the cops pulled him in for questioning. But then, you know, they weren't going to press him too hard because, well, he was too connected. You know,
exactly.
I talked about that. And, oh, he's a great guy. Just ask anybody, you know.
Yeah.
So I think she probably did it alone. I think she committed the murders at the bungalow. She dismembered Sammy's body there so that she could fit her in whatever cases that she could have three cases of Sammy of, and then took him to her apartment. And I don't know. I think I probably would have taken them straight to the train station.
Yeah, of course.
When I'm ready to leave, rather than take them to my apartment. But for whatever, you know, I don't know. We're trying to put ourselves in the heads
of course
someone who's not quite altogether.
Yeah.
Not deranged.
I'd be interested. Yeah. What kind of tools she used, and like, somebody should be able to tell, like, is this an experienced person at dismembering?
Yeah.
Things or not,
yeah. Right.
Imagine,
right. Right. Yeah.
It's not an easy thing to do. Yeah, I'm told
it's the Black Dahlia murder, or, you know, our buddy, the William Hickman, with Marion Parker. This is not something that you do easily. You know, that's not an easy job. And I mean, while Hickman ended up putting Marion back together, so to speak, and, you know, obviously Ruthie didn't make any effort to do that. It's still kind of wild.
And if you're liking this episode for whatever reason, like, go see a therapist, but also check out our Marion Parker episodes. If you haven't, I want to come home tonight. Check those out. It's two-parter, and it's something.
Yeah.
And then, okay, so she's found guilty, sentenced to death, eventually spared the noose. Do you know any more about these escapes? Like, is that?
Yeah, I don't know how she. I'm gonna guess this place didn't have a really, you know, really tight security. Would be my guess, because she escaped from that place seven times. She just kept walking out. I mean, I'm guessing she probably walked right out the door,
right?
And, you know, and pretended to be, you know what she was doing. You know, that we always talk about, just carry a clipboard, nobody will bother you.
Exactly.
And she walked right out of the place, and then the last time took off and was gone for years, 7 years.
She's right.
Just gone. And during that time was like a housekeeper and a maid and beloved by the family. And, you know, when they finally caught up with her, the family was like, yeah, we know she murdered her friends, but we really like her. And that was a long time ago. So here, we're going to hire the most famous attorney in San Francisco to represent her, you know. And eventually the governor said, you know, I guess she's gotten her act together, so I'm gonna go ahead and pardon her. And then she went back and lived with the family until she died, and, you know, in 1998. So honestly, not that long ago. So,
right. No, that wasn't even born yet. No, that's amazing. I was okay, but then the last thing is just I just love this the house where love dies.
I know, right?
That's
right?
Beautiful,
and it's like, not perfect. You know, and I'm not gonna say it, and neither is anyone else. Nobody says the house is haunted. You know, it's more like it's and you could even go as far as to say it's cursed. You know,
yeah.
You know, probably more cursed than haunted, but it's been a place that's just had a run of really bad luck, at least for couples who live there. And I mean, it's pretty well documented too. And, you know, it's just like, people move into this house and they move out separately usually. And it's just crazy. Well, it's, I mean, it's not a residence anymore. Now it's an attorney's office, which is, you know, obviously, you know, it's an attorney's office.
Yeah.
It's really cursed now. But even before that, you know, there were these stories around, and yeah, it's, this is one of my favorites. I have to admit,
really,
it really is. Even though it's, you know, I know it's only, you know, it's not, it's two murders, you know, but everything about this story is so bizarre and so just, I don't know. It's, you know, I think about the time period. You know, I like the 30s. I like to write about the 30s. I like to talk about the 30s. And something about this particular story, though, has been one that has always just sort of appealed to me, because I can't figure it out. I can't wrap my head around it exactly. I can't figure out why it happened the way that it did. And so anyway, I thought it would make a good episode to go along with our, you know, our houses that, you know, at least in this case, the house where love dies rather than just people. So
absolutely.
I mean,
absolutely.
Not that people didn't, because they did, but still, you know.
No, absolutely. Well, Troy, this is the time when I would normally bring up our ghostwriter segment. And still, if you have a question or comment about the world of the macabre, you can email us at AmericanHauntingsPodcast@gmail.com. But what I want to do is something we've been talking about. And I think it's time that we reintroduce the Podcast Listener of the Year Award.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about that. We did that, a couple of years ago, I guess. It's been a while. I remember we announce it at Dead of Winter or something?
At Dead of Winter. Yes. Oh, yes, we did. And so we only did it the one time. And it's basically a thing to, you know, showcase who has been our biggest fan or somebody that we've interacted with a lot.
Contributed a lot to the show.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Who won it first? I'm sorry. I don't remember. I'm sorry.
Oh, it was Mr. Mark Voorhees.
That's right.
Of the podcast.
Right. Yes.
And so we want to reintroduce that award. So if you think that you or somebody else you know should be the Podcast Listener of the Year for, I'm not sure when we're going to cut this off or when we're actually going to introduce it or whatever.
Well, we could just make it for the rest of the year. People can, and then we could announce it again at Dead of Winter if you want.
I think that'd be a great idea.
Why don't we just say for the rest of the year? People can. However you want to do it.
Well, hey, if you want to nominate yourself, great. If you think, I know it's weird, but some families like listen to the show. So if you nominate your mom or, you know, like my daughter or whatever. Yeah. Just let us know. Podcast Listener of the Year Award. Just send an email to AmericanHauntingsPodcast@gmail.com. And, you know, tell us why this person should be our Listener of the Year.
Yeah. Sounds cool.
Yeah. I think it'll be fun. I have no clue what they're going to get and what they're going to win, but we'll figure out something fun.
Yeah. Why not?
Troy, you got some haunt line stuff, I'm guessing.
Yeah, I do. And before our ad mid-roll in the middle of the show, I mentioned that they can hear about some free stuff. And so here it is. So over the next 2 weeks, we're going to randomly pick texts. It's our Halloween season. You know, we're going to randomly pick texts that come in on the haunt line. And if you get a message back asking for your address, we're going to send you something spooky and free in the mail.
Awesome.
So I'm just going to pick them at random. I will not. I won't just pick, you know, favorite people or something, you know, that I know have sent in a ton of texts. But
of course.
But I just thought that might be something fun we could do for Halloween, and maybe we'll continue it through October. So I do have just a couple of texts that have come in. And this one comes from Karen in Baltimore. Hey, Troy and Cody, I wondered if you had heard of the Yuba County Five, and if so, do you have any thoughts on what happened to them? I know it's not necessarily a ghost story, but it's something I think about every now and then. Would love to know the series of events that occurred to those five men. I do know about it. I usually post an article about it. I believe it's sometime in January was when they disappeared. It was five guys coming home from a basketball game in California and got lost in the mountains. But it was kind of a particular, these guys were, I believe, a group of mostly mentally challenged guys. There may have been one who was maybe more high functioning, who was the driver. But for some reason, they disappeared and they were later found. That's why they didn't end up on our, like, you know, disappearances season or in any of my the books I've done with Without a Trace books. because they were found, but they were found in very strange circumstances. There was a cabin that had food in it, but yet somebody starved to death. And it's an odd story. But yeah, I usually do post about it every year. So I've heard about it. And, you know, one of these times, maybe we'll have a season or something that will work out to cover something like that, because I think it would be interesting to people who aren't as familiar with it. So I also got a lot of texts from people who were pretty unhappy about about the mineral springs and not being able to do stunts anymore. And I know I had one that had come in from the 740 saying, I don't know if you can talk about this on the show, but are we concerned about the future of the paranormal in the Alton area? Because this year has changed so much. And, you know, and I think they're probably referring to the same people who bought the Mineral Springs also bought the First Unitarian Church last year, and they closed that down. And then, you know, the Mineral Springs, while not being closed, they ended the ghost hunts there. And, you know, we did some, I won't read into all this, but we did some complaining back and forth. So in this particular one, I think I used the word landlord overlords at some point, and some other things. But, you know, but they did make a good point, too, about it being frustrated that they own the buildings and could do with them what they please within certain parameters if they're historical buildings. But still, it's not even just the tourism that's leaving, but history and stories that we can't get back once the damage is done. But you know, they were happy to hear that we have plans to go forward, and that we're gonna try to keep Alton, you know, as haunted as possible, so to speak. It's only one small thing that's changing, and while it is disappointing, you know, it's just gonna happen. So this is another one that you're not going to like very much, at least the first part, but I'm going to give it to you anyway. This one comes to the 859. It has a name on it, but I'm not going to, I'll just say this is a person that says Chicago native living in Lexington, Kentucky, and I will not leave that. I will leave the rest of it out because it starts out, is Cody single? Because it's, again, we never answered it, and you don't have to either, but I think she is putting out her, you know, her advertising here. Fellow nerd here who likes spooky things and seems to specialize in being awkward. That's right up your alley. But anyway, hobbies include dressing up dead animals in people's clothes, decorating skulls, and leaving regrettable voicemails. Can cook, has cats, and a Star Wars tattoo sleeve. And also likes the show. Went back to listen to all the episodes, including the Patreon ones. They're all awesome. I'm sad I'm almost caught up. I guess years of listening. Oh, she says, currently on the Walter Collins episode, Womp Womp, because I tend to like to say that. I guess years of listening to loud music has made my ears trash because I never noticed the poor sound in season one. I'm hoping to one day make it to one of the tours and events, especially because I've read a lot about Alton in the countless books I've purchased throughout the years, some of which I didn't even realize were written by Troy until I was several seasons into the podcast. Anyway, always looking forward to the next one. So I think she's just giving you a hard time, but
I love it.
And anyway, because I think what happened is that we, you know, carefully don't answer questions like that. So that's it for the text line. So, or the haunt line. So, and remember, guys, if you've got a question or comment about the show, you can email us or you can text us at 217-791-7859. And your text might get read on the show, or you might win something free. So be sure to text us if you got anything you want to tell us, and who knows what you might get in the mail. So I just happened to pick up some very cool things recently, and I would love to send a few out. So
nice. And Troy, all I'll say is I absolutely admire. I don't care if you're going to strike out, as long as you take a couple swings, like you absolutely
yes,
have to.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
so
we have some time
anyway, yeah, but oh, did you catch that, Jen?
Anyway, yeah. So
this God, episode, I'm so sorry. I wasn't going to say her name.
Of the
so yeah, hit him up. Elsewhere. Anyway, just remember the next episode that we'll have coming out is October 8th. And then we will be bringing you a new episode every week in October. And I might just surprise you by throwing something out there that ends up on the live feed too, because, well, I'm almost done with the Patreon show, and so I may have a little extra time. So throw something out that Cody isn't even expecting. So anyway, keep listening and keep watching your feed, and you just never know. So
yeah, he never tells me.
Now
anything.
We're done. I'm so sorry.
No. All right. This is great. Okay.
This episode. Thanks for listening. Hauntings. No, I don't think so. It's my turn.
I'm sorry.
It's my turn. Thanks for listening. Remember, share the show with your friends, neighbors, anyone you know. And if you like the show, or even if you don't, leave us a 5-star review on iTunes anyway. Or you can send us an email or drop us a text on the hotline. You can also check us out on our social media, where you can find Cody and I on Facebook, Instagram, and now on Twitter. Actually, I was already on Twitter, but I changed my Twitter handle to be all about the American Oddities Museum. So I needed a theme. I needed a point to be on there, because really there is no other point. So I thought, hey, why not? So anyway, also, I think I'm supposed to say that we have, am I reading your part? No, I'm not.
Nope.
That we have shows on YouTube, but I'm going to let you cover that. So for now, just I'm going to do my last part, then you could talk about YouTube. Use a discount code podcast when shopping for books, tours, events, or whatever at AmericanHauntings.net. You'll also find the link there for Cody's shirt store, AmericanHauntingsClothing.com. And you can use the same code there, which is podcast, and you'll always get 10% off everything you order. Okay, now it's your turn.
It's like when you're hanging out with one of your best friends and they're like, I'm talking.
I like to say, excuse me for talking while you're interrupting. So
I should have been using that.
You could use that on me.
Years. Troy, the YouTube thing. So we finally have an easy solution now to push our episodes to YouTube. And this means our entire back catalog and everything. And so I have a lot of that set up. I'm kind of going through it and trying to figure out, how do I parse these out? Because I don't want to dump 180 episodes on people in one day,
everything. And keep in mind, there's no video with this. What is on it?
What's
it do? Just our podcast logo.
The one we use for the
use for the show. Oh, okay, gotcha.
Yeah, they'll know what episode it is. But we're working on that. And hey, if you're actually somebody that would rather, for some reason, listen on YouTube, like, let us know. I don't really know if that's
I don't know if anybody does or not. But
I get people would if it was like a video of us. But if it's just a graphic, I don't know. But hey,
doing that. So
not doing that because we both just look run down by the time we record.
Yeah, by the time we record, it's not pretty. So
it's like no. Anyway, this episode of the American Haunts podcast was written and performed by Troy Taylor. It was produced and edited by me, Cody Beck. To find out more about the show, check out our website at AmericanHauntingsPodcast.com, which features show notes, links, and sometimes photos that go along with each episode. Thanks again for listening.
Maybe next season.
We'll definitely do it without
Drop the ball somewhere. So,
Until next time, goodbye.
So long.
And see you later. Okay.
All right. Let me see if I can find that script real quick. Okay, we'll see what we can do. All right, you ready?
Yep.
Are you obsessed with America's darkest secrets, haunted places, unsolved crimes, mysterious disappearances, or stories that might keep you up at night?
If you can answer yes to this question, then we have the perfect show for you. It's called American Hauntings, and it's the podcast dedicated to the history, hauntings, legends, lore, and the dark side of American history.
My name is Troy Taylor, and I'm an author, historian, crime buff, and co-host of American Hauntings. In each episode, I use the research I've gathered over the past 3 decades to present a chilling event from America's past, presenting the facts, revealing the secrets, and debunking the misconceptions about each case. We all have questions, so I delve into the history of the story to try and answer them.
And that's where I come in. My name is Cody Beck, producer, editor, and the morbidly curious half of... And that's where I come in. My name is Cody Beck, producer, editor, and the morbidly curious half of the American Hauntings podcast. I follow up Troy's stories with questions, the questions you want to have answered. We curate... We currently have 7 seasons of the show for you to check out and discover how our unique blend of history, true crime, and the paranormal does its best to lighten some of the darkest events from America's past.
So check out the American Hauntings podcast wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts or at AmericanHauntingsPodcast.com. And be sure to leave the lights on when you listen.
I love it.
See what you can do?
Dude, do you think it'd be funny if... Should I leave?
Fall into big savings, all in the Kroger app. Get 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $4.99 each with your card and a digital coupon. Then buy one, get one free on our full line sale of tender Tyson chicken with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.